I had a body part scanned. Magnetic resonance imaging showed the exact track of the knife wounds in the liver. All this information meant that, although the police had already presented me with a variety of possible knives, each time I had confidently told them that no, the wounds proved this could not have been the murder weapon. When I finished listing the sequence of last events in the life of Rachel Nickell, a young woman whose name is widely known for the saddest of reasons, I felt bone-tired, world-weary. I looked at the clock, almost time to pick up the children and walk the dogs. I switched off the computer and listened to the faint groan it gives when extinguished. The dogs knew that sound and woke up simultaneously, yawning and stretching. They watched as I locked the photographs of the crime in my filing cabinet where no one, least of all the child, would stumble across them. Creating a reconstruction that really might help the police to find that young woman's killer did bring me great satisfaction. I would very shortly be 40, and this level of work represented the sort of contribution I had always believed it was possible for forensic pathologists to make to homicide investigations. The dogs were wagging their tails, waiting to go. I did not move. I did not want to come back to the here and now from this engrossing work, because there was something I had to do before dogs and children. Reluctantly, I picked up the phone and dialed one and then another in the list of numbers I had made from the yellow pages. "Hello, am I talking to the undertaker?" "Yes, sir, what can I do for you?" My father was dying in a hospice in Devon. He had advanced cancer and was receiving terminal care. A couple of days ago, I had said my sad farewells there, as court cases and other commitments dragged me back to London. My sister Helen had arrived to see him, and then brother Robert. I was making this call now, knowing that probably none of us would feel able to when the right time came. The voice at the other end sounded confused. "Sorry, I must have misheard. Did you say your father isn't actually dead yet?" "I'm afraid to say he soon will be, and I thought I'd organise things now." "I see." Was that shock or disapproval? I felt embarrassed. "I'm actually a forensic pathologist, so I work with death all the time, and I'm aware of the practicalities." "Ah." My plea of mitigation had been accepted. The formalities were therefore sorted out, and when the call came to say my father was dead, I was released from mundane details and could allow myself to grieve. Not to cry, of course, but to feel the immense loss of my good-hearted and much-loved father. He had somehow shuffled through a long retirement in Devon with Joyce awkwardly by his side. My life had not in any way revolved around him, but he was a constant presence. I phoned every Sunday, he wrote every fortnight. Always there, except now he wasn't. Something vast and unknowable seemed to gape at me. The immensity of death, which I always managed to evade in the course of my work, startled me by engulfing me now. A day or so later, I went to Devon and picked up the relevant forms from the hospice to take them to the Registrar of Births and Deaths as instructed. The envelope said, "Confidential, do not open." Naturally, I ignored this. My life is spent dealing with confidential details of the dead, and these were my own father's. As I waited at the registrar's, I opened the envelope and studied the contents without a qualm. A cold hand snatched the envelope from mine. "Just what do you think you're doing?" "Well, I was reading the..." "If you can read, you will have seen that these notes are confidential. You had absolutely no right to open them." My knuckles rapped, we proceeded to a small, shabby room for the formalities. Except that I had already seen on the paperwork that the doctor had given carcinoma of prostate as the cause of death. In the doctor's scribbled writing, it looked like carcinoma of prostate. I watched as the registrar, still stony-faced, laboriously wrote the death certificate. I said, "Excuse me, carcinoma is actually spelled with an I, not an E." She looked daggers at me. I'm a forensic pathologist. That's why I was interested to read my father's notes, and, well, I write the word carcinoma all the time, and I can assure you it is spelled with an I. The woman glared. The doctor has spelled it with an E. It is my job to write the cause of death exactly as it is given. Therefore, I shall write carcinoma, because that is how the doctor has chosen to write it. So my father's death certificate, which I had to send out many times, each time with a shudder of deep irritation, gave him a new and entirely unknown cause of death, called carcinoma. It would have annoyed him as much as it annoyed me, although he would have enjoyed his unique place in government statistics. 2 days before my midlife birthday, the shepherds gathered in Devon for a much bigger event, our father's funeral. Here was Helen, who lived in the north of England with her family. Here was Robert, who lived in France with his wife. Despite the geography, we all remained close. The night before the funeral, we had a family dinner with all the children, but, I'm sorry to say, without Joyce. I hope this wasn't unkind of us. I did remain in touch with her for the rest of her life and took responsibility to see that she was housed and cared for. But that night, we didn't want to censor any story about our father that predated her. We wanted to be free to exchange anecdotes about that wonderful man and his own special character. Not all of them were to his credit, but all of them he would have endorsed and enjoyed. We laughed a lot and drank his health, and it was truly an appreciation of his life. To die greatly admired by your children is no mean feat. He had been the eldest child in a large family, and when there was not enough money for education, and perhaps not enough love, to go round, he set out to create both those things for himself and his own family. Immersed in a sense of loss, but also of harmony and support among shepherds, we drove back to London. The kids in the back, me at the wheel, Jen at my side grabbing the opportunity for some sleep because junior doctors need all the shut-eye they can get. Another family, another generation. In fact, I felt some reluctance to leave Devon and go back to work. Guy's was a busy, stimulating, friendly place, and I loved my job, but unfortunately I'd run into turbulent waters lately. First, I was roundly attacked by my colleagues for complying with the police request for a reconstruction of Rachel Nickell's murder. "You're stepping right outside your area of expertise," they said. I pointed out that, actually, I had relied entirely on my expertise for the reconstruction. "And this is the way forensic pathology is definitely moving in America," I added. They were unimpressed by the way forensic pathology was moving in America. They shook their heads. They said, "When they arrest someone and the prosecution uses your reconstruction, defense counsel will slaughter you in the witness box." By now, I'd experienced enough public humiliation as an expert witness to know this was probably true. My other worry was the Marchioness. That tragedy had occurred 3 years earlier, but somehow the wreck of the pleasure boat kept resurfacing. Of course, the grief of those who had lost someone in the disaster could never end, and right now their grief was turning to anger. We professionals might have thought it was over for us. Some parts of the rescue and its aftermath had not gone smoothly, but the focus of attention since the collision had been on its causes. There were many safety systems that should have been in place on the Thames that night and weren't, and it was generally believed that the disaster happened because neither vessel saw the other in time, because neither kept a proper lookout. However, whatever the reason, the enormous Bow Bell had clearly ploughed into the little Marchioness, and criminal proceedings had followed against the Bow Bell's master. Victims' relatives were furious that the master had been drinking heavily the afternoon before the disaster, as he waited for the tide to change so that the dredger could head downriver. But experts, who didn't believe that the old RAF rule of 8 hours from bottle to throttle had a marine application, said the master had substantially slept off this alcohol intake in a nap before setting off that night. So the charge against him was his failure to keep a proper lookout. The coroner was forced by the Director of Public Prosecutions to adjourn inquests into the deaths until this criminal trial was over. But there never really was a result. 2 juries failed to reach a verdict on the culpability of the master of the Bow Bell, and a later attempt to prosecute the dredger's owners privately also faltered. After the Bow Bell verdict, or lack of one, the coroner decided it was not in the public interest to reopen the inquest, as by now there had been close examination of the causes of the collision, and safety had greatly improved on the Thames. But his decision added to the relative's pain. Some believed this was biased thinking, particularly after he made some unguarded comments about one of them to the press, which was subsequently published. The relatives not only wanted a full inquest, they wanted a full public inquiry. Both requests had been stonewalled, and it is to their great credit that their determination did not falter. They intended to pursue the possibility of an inquest through the Court of Appeal. However, their anger was fueled by their recent discovery, and unfortunately many of them made this discovery through the Sunday newspapers, that hands had been removed from some bodies in order to identify them. Even more upsetting than that, it had now been learned that the hands were sent back to the mortuary, but unforgivably, some were never actually returned to their bodies. And relatives suspected that the only reason they had been denied access to their loved ones before their funerals was not because the bodies were too decomposed for viewing, but because they lacked hands. Everyone now directed their anger at the pathologist in charge. That pathologist was me. In their position, I too would have been angry, but it was wretched to become the focus of such fury. It was no use saying to heartbroken, bereaved people that hand removal was routine in these circumstances. It was no use explaining that fingerprinting the decomposing drowned invariably requires laboratory technology which cannot be carried out at the mortuary. And it was too late to ask whether, just because this removal was standard at the time, it really was an acceptable routine. In fact, neither the decision to cut off the hands of some victims, nor their actual removal, nor the failure to replace them was anything to do with me. However, my denials were ignored and my protests taken as somehow incriminating. My photo, looking rather seedy, tie always flying behind me in a sinister fashion, kept appearing alongside newspaper articles, accusatory or snide in tone. I received phone calls from journalists at all hours of the day and night. I was frequently doorstepped. One hack appeared as though by magic in the office. I found him sitting by my desk, with solemn face and an ominously open notebook. As for my colleagues, their head shaking over my contribution to the Rachel Nickell case continued into my handling of the Marchioness case. They asked, couldn't I have stopped the hands from being removed, especially as, in most cases, other forms of identity were rapidly available? After all, hadn't the police reported that they were being swamped with dental records from across the globe? So surely, I should have intervened in the idiocy of the hand removal. My colleagues did agree, however, that they were all speaking without any experience of a mass disaster, and certainly not one due to drowning. And they agreed they were speaking with the advantage of hindsight, admitting they themselves would probably not actually have intervened in what was police standard practice at the time, especially since it had been authorised by the coroner. Ian, head of department, maintained a sphinx-like silence on the whole matter, as he did on any important cases which he was upset at missing. I felt entirely alone with the fury of the press and the Marchioness relatives, a difficult position, no matter how much I sympathised with that fury. Pam, who might have offered me some support, was no longer our chief organiser. Quite late in life she had fallen in love with a widower and stepped into the role of wife and stepmother. She didn't even try to mix pathology with homemaking. She recognised that the demands of running a family did not allow space for the complexities of the pathologist-homicide interface. We had bidden her a sad farewell. The other assistants then all reshuffled. A new junior appeared for us to introduce to our murky world of London murders, and the capable Lorraine was put in charge. Oh, and there was a new pathologist. One day, a tall, blonde, leggy woman had strolled into the office. She wore a short skirt and a friendly smile, and had cheekbones, which looked as if they had been cut out of stiff white paper with sharp scissors. The other staff barely had time to look up from their desks before Ian, as the most alpha in an office of alpha males, shot out of his seat and claimed her, yes, like a Neanderthal, because in the last century, the male sex was a great deal less evolved. Vesna Djurović was a forensic pathologist, half Serb, half Croatian, from what was then Yugoslavia. She was the, in those days, unusual combination of breathtakingly glamorous and highly skilled. She had been practicing in Belgrade and was now looking for a job in London. She not only found a job at Guy's, but also something she had perhaps not expected, a husband. Ian was already married, and the resulting manoeuvres were complex and difficult. but insofar as our dark landscape of homicide could shine with the celebrity couple, Vesna and Ian were soon it. Jen and I could never be such a couple. With Vesna and Ian in forensic pathology together, there became more social events involving partners, but we were too busy to join in most of them. Jen had just finished her house officer year. Her shifts were 36 hours, which meant long days and alternate nights in the hospital. However, this pattern was just beginning to ease now because she had started to train as a GP, at the same time finding what was to become her particular interest, dermatology. I knew that at this stage of her career, she needed a lot of support. I'd needed it too, and she'd been there for me. Now I was trying to do the same for her. Becoming a doctor was such an achievement when she hadn't even started studying until she was over 30. Probably I didn't express my pride often enough. I hope I expressed it sometimes. I mean, at least once, for heaven's sake. Now our paths seldom crossed, and when they did, we often argued. There didn't seem to be a mechanism to help us find our way back to a safer, happier place. I knew some couples reconciled in a loving, kind way, but I had never seen it happen. Certainly that kindness had been lacking in my father's relationship with my stepmother, and I wouldn't, or perhaps couldn't, play the game. How exasperated my good wife grew with her busy, distracted husband. "Why won't you let me love you?" Jen would cry. "Why are you so quiet all the time?" We went for counselling. I agreed to it, but all the same, I felt as if Jen was hauling me up before the beak. His mother died when he was 9, she said significantly, and the counsellor nodded. Also significantly, it seemed to me. Were they old friends, these two women, or was all womankind in some kind of conspiracy? "What would you like Dick to do for you, Jen?" the counsellor said. "Just put his arms around me and tell me he loves me. That's not much to ask, is it? And Dick, what would you like Jen to do for you?" I thought, but not for long. "Make me supper," I said. The counsellor leaned back in her chair, eyebrows raised. Jen's lack of culinary skills had always been a bit of a joke. Preparing and giving me a meal, that would be an act of love. But I'm always too busy looking after everyone to receive, and Jen's always too busy with her training to give. "So, Dick, you feel you look after everyone?" "I'm not complaining. My father did it too. He brought me up. I'm pleased to care for the kids and cook and be there for them. That feels normal. It's just..." My father had done all those things, but there had been his anger too. The way it occasionally just exploded out of him, whatever the collateral damage to those around. Now I began to wonder if that had in fact been the welling up of some great unhappiness. My father had been unhappy. Maybe I too was unhappy. It occurred to me for the first time that my marriage might be improved if, like him, I sometimes lost control and allowed my feelings to erupt. But if I had any such feelings, they were firmly buried in some inaccessible place. And if I couldn't even cry, how could I erupt? "Yes," said the counsellor. I had forgotten that I was sitting in this room now in Clapham, with ambulance sirens blaring outside, and my wife and a counsellor watching me, waiting for me to speak. She prompted, "You do the cooking and a lot of childcare, but it's just what?" "I'd like Jen to show me she loves me by doing things sometimes." The counselling didn't last long. Somehow it fizzled out, or maybe we were too busy. Our children were still primary school age. They were happy and healthy, and we worked hard to create a loving home. There was often noise, sometimes music, sometimes laughter. Jen and I were both fully involved in jobs we loved. We were comfortably off. I'd joined the parents' choir at the kids' school, and by now I'd become a loud, shameless, and I fear, usually tuneless singer. Jen, Chris, Anna, and I all sang our way up the motorway to holidays full of sand, rock pools, mountains, and moors on the Isle of Man, where we were received by generous and cherishing hosts. Our lives were surely good enough. Chapter 24. My 40th birthday coincided so closely with my father's death that it was inevitable I would start to contemplate my own demise. I did not fear death, but did not much like its predecessor, senescence, the pre-programmed process of aging. By now, I had seen so many bodies that I was all too familiar with the progress of senescence, and had a good idea what some of my own vital organs must look like. At 40, I knew that, on my lungs' smooth surfaces, tiny black dots were already forming into lines, making tree-like patterns. In their own way, the patterns might be rather beautiful, but this was filth, the sooty pollution of London, which alone had probably ensured that I already had a degree of emphysema, even without the 20 or more cigarettes I smoked each day. I wasn't the only smoker, of course. My colleagues smoked, and we worked in a perpetual blue haze. At home, Jen smoked. On the Isle of Man, her parents smoked. Everywhere, our friends smoked. In 1992, we all smoked. We smoked in pubs and restaurants. We smoked on trains, at our desks and on the bus. We knew it was bad for us. We knew that cigarettes contained over 4,000 constituents, many of which are toxic, from hydrogen cyanide to cadmium to benzopyrene. But we put up with all that for just one ingredient, nicotine. So far, we'd been young enough to think we were invincible. Now I knew that I must stop smoking, and I might be rewarded with an extra 10 years of life. Although the structure of my lungs must have been irreparably damaged, and inevitably that damage would increase over time. Pumping blood through damaged lungs is hard work for the heart, and I hope that the right side of my heart was not already enlarged by struggling with this extra burden. As for its left side, I knew that if I couldn't learn to control my reaction to stress, then my blood pressure would rise and my left ventricle would thicken trying to cope. The heart is an organ one can hold neatly in the palm of one's hand, so small but so steady, a little fist clenching and unclenching 70 times a minute, day and night, year after year, 30 billion times over a lifespan. A faithful friend, until it stops. It was down to me to repay its fidelity by managing my diet, exercise, smoking, and stress levels. Just as I knew I should give my liver a rest sometimes from alcohol if I wanted it to carry out its magical repair work on itself. Good resolutions, all of them, and quickly forgotten. An occasional whiskey and soda seemed a good way of relaxing, and it was much easier to light another cigarette than waste time contemplating how much I wanted one but couldn't have one. Stress relievers, both. And I see in retrospect that there was no question of my giving up that year or the next, because 1993 heralded a period of very significant cases. In April, I performed a routine post-mortem on a young black man from South London who had been stabbed. There were a lot of such knifings then, and this death looked like many others. They often turned out to be gang or drugs related. Racial attacks at that time were not immediately suspected. The only information I was given was that the young man had been in a fight. There was nothing to indicate to a pathologist that this was an unusual case, nor that the patient's name would become so well known, nor that I would have to give evidence about his death so many times. Stephen Lawrence was a bright, ambitious 18-year-old who in no way fitted wider public perceptions of black youth in 1993. Rightly or wrongly, his recognition as a keen student who had a professional future was vital to changing attitudes and prejudices. While simply waiting with a friend for a bus, he was stabbed twice by a group of white youths, who, we later learned, were hurling racist comments. There was a superficial incision on his chin, one deep stab wound that had penetrated his lung, and another deep wound on the shoulder. Bleeding profusely, he somehow managed to get up and run over 100 meters with his friend before finally collapsing. In the months that followed, I was shown by the police a total of 16 knives, of which 7 were possible murder weapons. One of these looked particularly likely. In July, I was asked to make a further statement and said that, in my opinion, Stephen had been standing when he was stabbed around the right collarbone, but had probably begun to fall by the time the second stab wound was inflicted on his left shoulder. Despite some very careful thought, I wasn't able to say with full confidence whether his assailant was right or left-handed. Choosing one over the other might have made me look clever, but the evidence was really too flimsy to risk exonerating the perpetrator. That was the extent of my involvement with the police's investigation into Stephen's death at that time. I was unaware of the indifference and racism that were hampering it. The Lawrence family, however, were not. They understood there were witnesses, evidence and indeed suspects, but no charges were made. 4 months later, I was called to observe a coronial post-mortem in North London on behalf of the police. The postmortem was actually performed by another pathologist. It was my job to watch, take any relevant samples, and possibly participate if invited to do so. But on the other pathologist's insistence, I just watched. It was fairly clear to me that the woman we were examining had died of the adverse cerebral consequences of asphyxiation, but there might be other causes of death revealed by the experts who were invited to give their specialist opinions on some of the organs, specifically the brain and the heart. The deceased had obviously been involved in a fierce struggle and then manhandled into a body belt, that abdominal belt with the handcuffs attached. She was covered in cuts and bruises and had been bound at the thighs and ankles as well as the waist. Had she, in fact, sustained a head injury also? The brain pathologist would answer that question for me. This case also turned into a significant one. Joy Gardner was a 40-year-old Jamaican who lived with her 5-year-old son. That she had outstayed her visa and was in the UK illegally is not in dispute. Her mother and a large number of relatives were here, offering support while she studied, and she did not want to return to Jamaica. Early one morning and without warning, immigration officers arrived at her home to deport her. They were supported by police officers, perhaps because resistance was expected, and Joy Gardner did resist. She must have thought she was fighting them for her way of life. She perhaps did not guess that she was fighting for her life. Unskilled, untrained, and determined to carry out orders, the officers struggled to get her into a restraining belt while she fought them and bit them, watched by her young son. In response to her biting, they wound almost 4 meters of 1-inch wide adhesive surgical tape, elastoplast, around her mouth and face. They mistakenly believed that by leaving her nose clear, they were allowing her to breathe. This is a myth. Covering the mouth can kill. It is not just a question of being able to breathe. It's a question of being able to breathe enough. Especially if a struggle has caused stress and exertion and massively increased the body's need for oxygen. In these circumstances, an individual simply cannot take in the oxygen needed, which may be many times more than usual. Gagging can cause vomiting, and with the mouth blocked, vomit obviously cannot escape. So it gets into the airways. And a gag can press against the tongue, pushing it to the back of the mouth and blocking the back of the nose. Secretions also accumulate in the mouth and throat, and this further inhibits the ability to get air into the lungs. Gagging a distressed woman who had been struggling hard for many minutes was all it took to bring about cardiac arrest. Joy Gardner was not strangled. There was no traumatic head injury. She'd not inhaled her own vomit. She was asphyxiated by the gag. However, an ambulance crew managed to resuscitate her. That is, they restarted her heart and then rushed her to hospital, where she was placed on life support. Sadly, her brain had been so badly damaged by the prolonged lack of oxygen that she died 4 days later. There was a breadth of involvement in this case, hospital, police, family. And consequently, her body underwent so many postmortems and so much tissue analysis that meetings about Joy Gardner sometimes felt like pathology conventions. Among the most important were the brain specialists, since it had been alleged by the first pathologist whose postmortem I had watched that she had died from a head injury. Finally, overall, there was broad general agreement that she had died from asphyxia caused by the gag. I wrote a detailed report examining all the possible causes of death, which, as usual, went through various drafts and revisions. In the meantime, there was a growing outcry from human rights organizations and others. It seemed to many, especially members of the black community, that police officers regarded deportation as a job to be done at any cost, and that they had killed Joy Gardner by thoughtlessly over-restraining her. You might remember that the first death in custody I encountered, caused by restraint, had left me feeling some discomfort at the coroner's verdict. That patient had both pneumonia and sickle cell trait, and so was deemed to have died of natural causes aggravated by lack of care. From that day, I had been concerned about the methods sometimes used by enforcers of the law. It was obvious that some simply didn't know how to restrain people safely. And restraint, indeed death from restraint, was definitely on the increase. Joy Gardner was restrained so that she could be deported. Other deaths were caused when the police tried to apprehend suspects, particularly if those suspects had sickle cell trait. But most deaths we were seeing caused by restraint now were due to another factor, the spiraling use of just one drug. That drug was, of course, cocaine. Cocaine blocks the brain's uptake of neural transmitters, and the blockage can give continual pleasurable stimulation. It gives confidence, euphoria, and energy. Cocaine users can talk for hours, have heightened responses to physical stimuli, so sex is more enjoyable, and they have little need for food or drink. It can, however, lead to a greatly stimulated heart rate, agitation, and psychosis. So, if restraint is required for a cocaine user, it is usually because he appears to be suffering from uncontrolled psychosis. My first cocaine death came at about this time, and it was an early marker in Britain's rising cocaine use. A very large and muscular drug dealer, who was himself an addict, was arrested, having just bought a large quantity of cocaine, and at once began to punch the two police officers detaining him. An officer stuck an arm around his neck, but that was just one maneuver in what was pretty much a fight. The fight ended with the dealer's death. But how had he actually died? A highly regarded neuropathologist confirmed that the dealer did not sustain a head injury in the fight, so that was not a cause of death. He may have been asphyxiated by the arm around his neck, but he showed only one of the three classic signs of this, insufficient to give asphyxiation as a cause of death. He had consumed a lot of cocaine, but his blood sample put him below the fatal level, so he probably did not die of an overdose. Finally, I gave a combination of causes. The stress on his heart generated by his fight with the police, coupled with the fundamental stress caused by his cocaine use. Although a young man, he suffered from an inflammation of the heart muscle. Now, this is recognized in cocaine users and sometimes called cocaine myocarditis. Charges against the two police officers were later dropped, but this was another case that left me with a sense of discomfort I could not ignore. There were simply too many deaths when police officers restrained people. They surely believed that they were simply doing their duty, and they certainly had no intention of killing anyone, but people were dying. I knew I would have to do something, but it wasn't clear to me yet what I could do. While we waited to see if anyone would be arrested for Joy Gardner's death, headlines everywhere announced an arrest for Rachel Nickell's murder. It came as no surprise to me. I had been aware of the police's suspicions about a man called Colin Stagg. I knew that, in the absence of forensic evidence, they had set up a honey trap on the advice of a psychological profiler. They recorded intimate sexual conversations between Stagg and an undercover policewoman, hoping Stagg would reveal himself as Nickell's murderer. He did not, but the Crown Prosecution Service thought that what he did say was incriminating enough. I answered a number of questions about the murder from the team targeting Colin Stagg, and my reconstruction of events that day on Wimbledon Common was used as evidence for the prosecution. I was expected to appear as a witness at the trial the following year. With Britain's most notorious murderer now believed to be safely on remand and awaiting trial, I was surprised to be called in the autumn to the body of another young woman. She had been the victim of an even more deranged attack than that on Rachel Nickell. Jack the Ripper, who killed at least five women in East London in 1888, is still the stuff of film, fable, and countless guided walks daily around Whitechapel. I suspect that the public is so fascinated by his gruesome crimes because they happened long ago. Samantha Bissett's name, and that of her killer, are barely known. I believe because she was the victim of such a truly shocking, Ripper-type murder, that the press, for once, was reluctant to inflict on readers the horrific information unfiltered by Time's lens. I feel the same reluctance, and do not here give details of this homicide. Not only was Samantha killed and sexually assaulted, but also her four-year-old daughter, whose body was then tucked into bed with her toys, so that the first police officers on the scene harbored hopes, soon dashed, that she had safely slept through the murder of her mother. I was called in by the coroner, my interest in knife crime now widely acknowledged, to carry out the second post-mortem on the bodies of Samantha Bissett and her daughter. This second post-mortem was not for the defense, since no one had been charged with the murder, but for the coroner, so that the bodies could be released. It had fallen to a colleague to visit Samantha Bissett's flat, where these crimes had taken place. Therefore I saw the scene only through the photographer's lens. I could imagine the terrible silence, how the usual camaraderie, the exchange of pleasantries, inquiries about families or holidays, the workaday stuff we use to remind ourselves of normal life when we are confronted by a homicide, how even that must have been impossible for all investigators in the home where these acts of cruelty and mutilation had occurred. As I carried out the post-mortem, it became clear to me that the killer had been, like Jack the Ripper, something of a trophy hunter. I said to the police officers attending, "If I didn't already know you've got Colin Stagg, I could really think this was carried out by the same bloke as Nickell's murder." The senior officer shrugged. "No way, we've got Stagg and he's as good as confessed." "It's not that similar," pointed out his colleague. "No one mutilated Rachel Nickell." "Maybe you would have done if he hadn't run out of time. Maybe he wanted to enjoy himself killing her, but he was in a public place, and he just couldn't do that without getting caught. Killing a woman slowly, in her own home, probably would have been the next step for him, too." "Yeah, well, he's inside, and he's staying there for the rest of his life," said the officer. And soon, the same could be said of the man who killed Samantha Bissett. Robert Napper was a 28-year-old warehouseman with a history of violence and mental illness. He had often been brought to police attention, but somehow, perhaps due to poor record-keeping in those days before the widespread use of computers, he had always slipped under the radar. Now his fingerprints in Samantha Bissett's flat connected him to this crime. On his arrest, the police were confident that they had taken two ruthless murderers, Stagg and Napper, off the streets. So it was a very great shock when, in September 1994, Colin Stagg was acquitted. The case was thrown out by a judge, who said that the police operation was nothing more than entrapment, and that, because Stagg had been lured into talking to the undercover policewoman, anything he said was inadmissible evidence. I was as astonished as everyone else. The police had worked with many professionals on the case, and it had not occurred to me to challenge their absolute certainty that Colin Stagg had killed Rachel Nickell. Colin Stagg was released, but into a different sort of jail. He only had to walk outside his front door to be subjected to immense cruelty. The police, press, and most of all the public were still convinced that Stagg had murdered Rachel Nickell and somehow got off on a legal technicality. This belief was so widespread that it didn't even occur to me to draw attention once again to the similarity between Nickell's killer and Bissett's. I had learned only too well that expert opinion is marginalized by the system. And despite my brief foray into crime reconstruction, I was now firmly back in my box. Chapter 25. The relatives of those who died when the Marchioness went down had doggedly been pursuing their case all these years. Now they won a victory. When their attempts to persuade the coroner to reopen an inquest had got nowhere, they had turned to the Court of Appeal, which agreed that, by refusing them an inquest, the coroner was in real danger of showing unfair, though unconscious, bias. As a result, an inquest was finally held by another coroner. 6 years after the disaster, in 1995, the inquest jury agreed 9-1 that the victims were unlawfully killed. There was no one to prosecute now, since two attempted prosecutions of the Bow Bells master had failed, but the verdict fueled the relatives' belief that there should be a public inquiry. An action group continued to push for one. Their efforts were resisted by the authorities because there had been a complete overhaul of river safety as a result of the accident, and it was argued that there would be nothing now to be gained by a public inquiry. The action group did not agree. Although it must have taken a great personal toll on them to continue their fight, the relatives insisted there was more to learn from their suffering and that a public inquiry was the best forum. No one ever forgot the missing hands of the victims, and I was still held responsible for this. So, while I agreed with the reason the relatives wanted an inquiry, I dreaded it, because the whole subject, including those hands, would surface yet again. Pressure from the ground up on intransigent authorities was also evident in other important cases at that time. The investigations into the deaths of Joy Gardner and Stephen Lawrence, 2 years on, just seemed to be fizzling out. Except that there were many people who were not going to let that happen. First relatives, then whole communities, set out to mobilize public opinion by showing that, in the case of Stephen Lawrence, racism in the Metropolitan Police was hindering the investigation. In the case of Joy Gardner, they had to show that someone other than a court had decided to exonerate the officers involved. At first, not much changed in the Lawrence investigation. However, to the astonishment of the Met, who insisted their staff had only been doing their job, prosecutors now charged three officers with the manslaughter of Joy Gardner. At that trial, a QC gave me a cross-examination I shall never forget. Someone had leaked a copy of an early draft of my report on the case, and he pointed out that in my final draft there were over 70 changes. He dragged me through them, one by one, asking me to justify every word change, deleted comma, or additional semicolon. I felt my minor revisions, for instance changing probably to possibly, or quickly to rapidly, made little difference to the overall case, but it was useless to say that in each draft I was refining and clarifying. The QC's clear implication was that I worked closely with the police and had been leaned on to make them appear less culpable for Gardner's death. Our exchanges went something like this, and I'm writing from memory since no transcript seems to have survived. QC, let us look at page 36. Why did you revise the word severe to moderate, Dr. Shepherd? For that was certainly a dramatic revision. Me, it seemed on reflection a more appropriate description. QC, but why was it more appropriate? Me, well, I considered all the facts again very carefully and revised my opinion. QC, are you sure that revision wasn't based on the receipt of further information? Me, it was based entirely on my analysis of the case. QC, but why would you make so extreme a change if you had no new information? Me, I felt it was more correct. QC, so are you saying you changed your mind? Me, indeed, I changed my mind. QC, you simply changed your mind, changed it on a mere whim? I can see why he was suspicious. Of course, I regularly worked with police officers, and it might have seemed a fair assumption that I was trying to please them. In fact, no one had leaned on me, nor do I try to please. Yes, it might have felt awkward working with the Met if I had been instrumental in convicting three of its officers. That is the sort of dilemma I had always known a forensic pathologist must face occasionally. I had hoped that I would respond bravely to pressure and treat truth as my greatest ally. Scandalously to many, all three officers were acquitted. Personally, although I could not condone their actions, it was clear to me that the officers were themselves victims in a way, victims of an entirely flawed system. They had not been trained or informed how to restrain safely. They had not been warned about the possibly dangerous effects of their actions. They did not know the rights or wrongs of Joy Gardner's deportation. It was their duty physically to carry out the orders of bureaucrats who made their decisions on behalf of the British people. They thought that by restraining Joy Gardner, they were simply doing the unpleasant job they were paid for. The fact that they did it so badly, I felt, reflected on their employer's bad practice. Joy Gardner's sad death was a catalyst for change. For me, it was the last straw. I knew now what I had to do. I became an active and enthusiastic part of, indeed sometimes the instigator of, bodies set up not just to review restraint procedures, but to train properly anyone whose job requires them to restrain, principally police, prison, and immigration officers. It is impossible to know what will later be the significance, if anything, of one's own life. I'd like to think that in my case it will be my contribution to this change. It has largely been a question of making a nuisance of myself, running training courses, organizing conferences, writing reports, sitting on committees, but most of all, education. Detractors of the police may be surprised that I found most officers extremely keen to learn correct and humane restraint. They, more than anyone, were aware of the deficiencies in their practice. They, more than anyone, knew that it wasn't just the families and friends of the victims who suffered. It was also officers' lives and careers which could be completely changed by the events of a few minutes. However, it was many years before every single organisation which can lawfully restrain, from the Border Agency to the Youth Justice Board, finally endorsed the set of principles for safer restraint that we succeeded in introducing to Metropolitan Police training after the Joy Gardner case. I became a member of the Independent Advisory Panel to the Ministerial Board on Deaths in Custody. It is jointly sponsored by the Departments of Health and Justice, as well as the Home Office. Sounds bogged down in bureaucracy? It isn't. That's just how much elbow power we needed to ensure the set of guidelines I wrote would be approved and adhered to. The guidelines recognise that restraint can have a significant psychological effect on everyone involved, including those who witness it. They set out the principle that restraint should be used only when it is necessary, justifiable, and proportionate to the perceived threat. And they acknowledge the possibility that poorly applied restraint can lead to death. So only approved techniques should be used, and only by trained, authorised staff. Once an incident is underway, management is essential. I like to think that the guidelines here were influenced by my flying experience. Where there are two pilots in a plane, only one is in full control. And when control is passed from one to another, both pilots must verbally acknowledge this. Pilot 1, I have control. Pilot 2, you have control. This routine brings clarity in a crisis. So I had the idea of transferring aviation practice to the crisis which is a restraint situation. In this crisis, the person who is responsible for the detainee's head, neck and breathing is the person in control. It doesn't matter if it's the lowest ranking officer present, that person must take control by saying, I now have control of this incident. The others must acknowledge with, you now have control of this incident. Crucially, control gives the authority to order an immediate release and be obeyed. There is more detail, of course, involving medical monitoring, filming, records and debriefing. But the overall aim was to turn the rugby scrum of forcible detention into something used only when necessary and in a well-managed and safe way. The result, I believe, has been a dramatic reduction in the number of restraint deaths by the authorities. In fact, it is now much more dangerous to be arrested by a fellow citizen or shop or nightclub security staff. After the acquittal of the officers in the Joy Gardner case, there were calls for a public inquiry, which were resolutely resisted. As for the Stephen Lawrence case, it was clear the police investigating knew some names and had suspicions. However, no prosecution followed, and so Stephen's parents and friends began a heroic and dignified struggle for justice. They pressed ahead with their own civil prosecution of 3 of the 5 alleged killers. I was called as a witness at this trial. Michael Mansfield, QC, was acting for the family in the unaccustomed position of private prosecutor. But it was all to no avail. The world watched as the proceedings collapsed almost before they started, for lack of evidence considered admissible by the judge. Worse, the double jeopardy law at that time meant that the 3 who were tried could never again be tried for the same crime, and it seemed that all possibility of justice was lost for the Lawrence family. However, they did not accept this. They now demanded an inquest. It seemed public opinion was fully behind them. Many had been shocked by the acquittal of the officers involved in the Joy Gardner case. Now people were beginning to believe that the investigation into Stephen's case was hampered by the same sort of racism that had led to his death. And even a public inquiry, established only at the behest of a government minister and something considerably larger in scale and much more legally powerful than the coroner's inquest, began to look like a real possibility. The Lawrence family's patience and persistence finally did lead to an inquest. The 5 suspects were ordered to appear. They did so, but refused, as was their legal right at an inquest, to answer any questions. The coroner, who is not legally allowed to actually name murderers, was helpless in the face of their rude silence. However, the jury found a way around that and cleverly concluded, in February 1997, that Stephen Lawrence had been unlawfully killed in a completely unprovoked racist attack by 5 white youths. They might as well have said, by the 5 white youths sitting over there. And the Daily Mail more or less did so, publishing pictures of the 5, naming them, and inviting them to sue if the Mail was wrong. Public scorn at the failure to apprehend Stephen's attackers reached such a pitch that at last it really began to seem that demands for a public inquiry into the Met's investigative failures would be met. I was personally delighted by this strong move for change, which was now forcing a rethink in official and police culture. it had not escaped my notice that so many of the deaths in custody or under restraint I had been dealing with were the deaths of black people. And, put simply, the potentially increased vulnerability of some individuals through sickle cell trait certainly did not explain this disparity. I could see change was necessary, but I could not imagine how change might come about. It never occurred to me when I examined the body of Stephen Lawrence that precisely those knife wounds would, over the next 20 years, be the precipitating factor in that change. Chapter 26. After about 8 years at Guy's, I had itchy feet. The wing of Ian West had become more smothering than sheltering, and despite our friendship and his many promises to promote me, he had not done so. I applied directly to the medical school dean behind his back for senior lectureship and was immediately promoted. But Ian really didn't want me, or perhaps anyone else, to become his deputy. As for his possible early retirement, to embrace fully his country squire lifestyle of hunting, shooting and fishing, well, Ian made it clear that was not even on the distant horizon. I looked quietly for other openings and continued with my work. By now, approaching the mid-1990s, both my children were at secondary school, and occasionally I could glimpse in their young faces the adults they would become, rather than the small children they had once been. It had always been hard to carry out postmortems on children who were the same age as my own kids. This was probably the one time my hand wavered, momentarily, over a body. And now that they were growing up, there seemed to be more cases involving children. Had I been avoiding them before, or were they really on the rise? One day, I was called to examine a baby who had died in his mother's arms at 10 months. I found him to be well-nourished and well-grown. There had obviously been resuscitation attempts, but there were no other marks on him, and certainly no sign of violence or trauma. The internal examination was just as unrevealing. There was not one indication of abnormality. I waited for the toxicology, virus, and bacteria test results, but decided that if they were all clear, I would have to give sudden infant death syndrome as the cause of death. The police were not too happy that I was thinking SIDS and promptly handed me a bundle of background notes. Ah, now the case had a context, and what I read seemed to change things. Officers had arrived at the mother's flat in response to her 999 call. She was 22 years old and lived alone after receiving death threats from the baby's father. Those threats, but also the mother's drinking habit, had placed the 10-month-old baby on the at-risk register. To protect them against the father, an attack alarm had been installed in the home. When the mother phoned the emergency services at about 9 p.m., she sounded drunk and referred to a death in the family. The attack alarm rang too, but only as police were actually on their way to the flat. The police were concerned because only a month before, this young mother had been convicted for being drunk in charge of her child. This is an offence that carries a fine and rarely a custodial sentence. Its main purpose seems to be either to humiliate mothers into sobriety or to alert social services to the possibility of neglect or abuse. On arrival, only 7 minutes after her call, the police rang the bell. No one came to the door. They peered through the letterbox and could see the mother pacing up and down the hallway with the baby in her arms. She was not panicking, and there was no obvious threat, so they did not break in. They gently persuaded her to open the door, although she had great trouble doing this because she was so drunk. When eventually the police were able to enter, they found that the baby she had been cradling was dead. All attempts were made at resuscitation. The mother was angry, aggressive, and of course upset. A couple of hours later, a blood sample was finally taken. And from this, it was possible to extrapolate her blood alcohol level at the assumed time of the baby's death, that is, when she dialed 999. The level was 255 milligrams per 100 millilitres of blood. It's illegal to drive above 80 milligrams in England and Wales, now 50 milligrams in Scotland. And for a less hardened drinker, 255 milligrams per 100 millilitres could possibly be a fatal dose. So we can conclude that, although she was clearly accustomed to alcohol, the mother was very drunk indeed. The sample revealed no evidence of any drug use. However, she was too drunk to explain whether the child had died in her arms, or in his cot, or on the sofa or her bed. and she was unable to say where she had been at the time. Perhaps your sympathy for the bereaved parent is now strained. Perhaps mine was. I had the baby's blood tested for alcohol and drugs. By now, we had begun to recognize that some parents who drink or take drugs, in order to keep their children quiet while they do so, administer to them the same substances they enjoy, and sometimes they administer a fatal dose. However, when the toxicology report came, it revealed that this was not the cause of the baby's death. There are fads in illnesses, as in most things. Their popularity waxes and wanes according to our perceptions. Sudden infant death syndrome, where an apparently healthy baby dies for no evident reason, gradually entered the public consciousness during the 1970s and 1980s, and by the early 1990s, it had become statistically significant, peaking at 2 per 1,000 live births. SIDS was a welcome diagnosis for many pathologists. It seemed to explain the unexplainable, and it cleared parents or carers of any blame. SIDS says that the baby did not die of any unnatural cause, and so the assumption must be that it died of natural causes. But SIDS was not universally acceptable. There were some police officers and non-medical coroners who were skeptical. In this case, the police suspected that the drunken mother's hand had been involved in the baby's death. This was reasonable in the circumstances, except that there was simply no evidence at all to support it. Therefore, having excluded all other possible causes of death, I was left with SIDS. There were many changes in my life immediately after this, and I was to look back on the cause of death I gave in that case just 1 year later and feel some surprise. This was, in fact, my last case at Guy's. I had learned of the forthcoming retirement of Dr. Rufus Crompton from my alma mater, St. George's Hospital in Tooting. He was my former teacher and mentor, who now headed a department of which he was the sole member of staff. The opportunity to replace him was really exciting. St. George's was willing to grow the department, and if I got the job, I'd be able to expand it along the managerial lines that I was always suggesting to Ian, and which he completely ignored. One grey day, I asked Lorraine if Ian was free, and then walked rather nervously into his office. It was a large room filled with utmost chaos. Stacks of files and other papers teetered on the desk, on every shelf, on the floor, and on the huge table at the centre of the room which was used for meetings. When one was scheduled, Lorraine would move all the piles of paper off the table, finding some corner of the floor for them, and take away the overflowing ashtrays and the old cigarette packets. When the meeting was over, it would all start again. Judging from the clutter on its surface, I estimated that it had probably been over a week since the last meeting. Ian was sitting at his desk and did not immediately turn his huge jowls towards me when I came in. This was perhaps not the best time to approach him, because I knew he was tired. Yesterday he had been shouting, which always meant that whoever he appeared to be angry with, he was actually angry with himself, generally because he had failed to do something. Although, of course, he blamed Lorraine. She had not reminded him to produce that report on time. The report had almost certainly been sucked into the vortex of other files on his office floor, but the court had been unsympathetic and ordered him to produce it by this morning at the latest. So he and Lorraine had been in the office until late last night, he dictating, she abandoning her shorthand pad and typing directly into the computer. Now he sat with a menthol cigarette between his fingers, another forgotten, burned in the ashtray by his microscope, and a third lay, smoke spiralling from it to one side of the room next to the flickering screen of his huge desktop computer. I said, Ian, you probably heard that Rufus Crompton is retiring. He raised his eyebrows. It had long been understood between Rufus, me and Ian that one day I might like to go back to St. George's. I'm planning to apply for the vacancy, I said. He lit another cigarette from the end of the one he was finishing, looked around for an ashtray, or anyway one that wasn't already full, failed to find such a thing, and stubbed out the spent cigarette on the packet. I suppose you'll be needing a reference, he said. He smoked even more furiously than usual, but did not betray emotion in any other way. He was cordial and wished me luck in my application, and we agreed that, if we were both to run departments, we would not be rivals, but highly cooperative with each other. I'm not sure either of us meant it, though. We were rivals already, and now that we were to be equals in different hospitals, that rivalry was unlikely to cease. Leaving busy guys with its famous departmental head and plethora of fascinating cases, to leap into the unknown was scary. I took a break that summer from postmortems as I moved to St. George's and began